Yeah, that's a very important and interesting question, because sometimes, at least in my experience, and I feel like other people can relate to this, sometimes you end up suddenly realizing that you're doing a lot of things you didn't anticipate. And maybe even it gets to the point where what you originally set out to do feels minimized or obscured or in the least difficult to focus on. And that could be, different for each person. But in my case, I got into this because I just wanted to be the best cellist that I could possibly be, and to share that with people and move people through music to give them an experience that would inspire them. I love listening to music when I was a kid. The cello is my favorite instrument, and performing with the best musicians that I could find has always pushed me. And I very strongly, especially when I was a kid, or maybe especially at many different points in my life, I always felt that, like, if you can have that sort of open experience as a performer and bring an audience to the place where they are also open, then you can both be surprised by what happens, and the beautiful things can take place on a level that we may not even be able to understand or articulate. So that's always been my passion. Along the way, you have to do various things. You go to music school, you go to competitions. I joined an orchestra for a while. You get management, perhaps, or whatever the path is. And then I started curating. I started composing. All of these things, and some of them came up because they were exactly in line with where I thought I was wanted to go. And some of them felt like sidesteps at the time and were necessary. I would say that when I made the decision to audition for an orchestra, I was in the Seattle Symphony for 2 years, and when I made the decision to audition for that, it felt like a sidestep. It wasn't exactly what I wanted to do, and so I lined up four auditions, and somehow in the process of preparing for those auditions without really having a teacher, it was the first time that I had to kind of define my own approach to music, and so that was very helpful. And I ended up feeling like not only the experience of being in an orchestra was tremendously valuable when I left and started working with orchestras, but also the process of preparing for the auditions was very important because I was doing it on my own and having to find my own way using the tools that my teachers had given me. So a sidestep that ultimately helped me get exactly where I wanted to go, and I never would have guessed, and now I don't consider it really a sidestep at all.
But when,
In fact, I
let me
go
just
ahead.
ask you, Joshua, about that, because when you made the decision to audition for the orchestras and you felt it was a sidestep, what did you think it was a sidestep away from? Like, what was there a vision of something else?
Well, I think in the plainest terms, I always wanted a solo career. And I definitely feel like that is not entirely necessary to do a lot of the things that I wanted to do, but to do everything that I wanted to do in terms of being able to challenge myself, communicate with other people, and share deeply and on the broad kind of level that I envision with the exact music that I loved, the falling in love with the Dvorak concerto and wanting to play that all the time basically means you have to be a soloist. I mean, you get a few other opportunities if you're a principal cellist and sometimes if you're a teacher, but it's not as many as I was hoping for. So that's why it felt like it could be a sidestep. And that's only, I think, even a recent thing. And historically, there are plenty of solo cellists who were in orchestras before or during, and even recently, like Lynn Harrell was a great example. He was in the Cleveland Orchestra, so it's not impossible, but it wasn't the prescribed path that everyone sort of said you had to do. It was all about competition, and that just wasn't going to work. So at each of these each of these points, I've had to, you know, sort of try to find, does it fit into what I'm doing? Is it a sidestep or is it an expansion or even a detraction? And right now what I'm doing is trying to go back to that original passion and find what it really is about that that drew me to it. It's not just the sound of the cello. The sound of the cello is a big part of it. It is much more than that. In fact, for a long time, the main drive was the idea that music can be a force for good and help bring people together and help them realize something deeper that we all share and have these beautiful experiences. So in that way, adding something like composition doesn't necessarily take me away from what I'm really trying to do. In fact, I can write for the cello and have everything. I can be helping creatively curate the actual experience on a level that I can't reach if I'm playing music that's already been written and already around and people have a preconceived notion about.
Yeah. I listened to your recording of Riding Light YouTube channel, and I thought it was fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, I wonder where, when you first started composing, was there something specific that you were, like, did it surprise you, or was this something you'd always done as a kid, or improvised? Like, I'm wondering, yeah.
It was a mixed bag of experience as far as before I got my first commission. Mm-hmm. I had improvised and I don't remember. I mean, my dad put me up with his church band. I must have been 10, 9, 10, 11. I don't know. And you know, said, play along. And there was no music. So I had to make my own lineup. And that's been around. I have a couple of 5-line things that I quote unquote composed.
Yeah.
But they don't really count. So that, and I took 2 or 3 composition lessons in college with my friend Dan. So I don't know if that really counts. So I didn't really have a history of doing it, but I had started. The other big piece of the puzzle for me is not just the personal exploration and the direct communication with the audience, but also my relationship with the classical music community. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of, let's say the ground is not entirely stable right now. And sometimes that's a bad thing. And sometimes that's actually a very good thing because it causes us to examine the plot of land that we're sitting on and why. And looking back, I just started to really question this division that came about between the performer and the composer.
Yeah.
Because it used to not exist. I mean, there were obviously some people who were more known for being a composer than a performer, and plenty of performers, I'm sure, that wrote terrible music and so just never tried it again. But essentially, the training was to be able to be a well-rounded musician.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really divided until the 20th century. So I feel very much like one of the ways that we as a community can get back to a place where we're sharing more directly and with more relationship to the people around us is by getting in touch with our inner creativity, especially the performers out there who have only played music that other people have written and never improvised and never written their own music. So discovering your own voice takes getting uncomfortable, but it helps. I think it helps with all of the decisions that are made in programming, in talking about music, and even in interpreting other people's music. So I'd already started to think all of that when the first opportunities sort of came along. And I hadn't only been thinking that, I'd also been talking about that with people. And so I kind of felt like, oh my gosh, well, when this opportunity came along, it's like, I can't say no because then I'm just a big hypocrite. So, so So I jumped in, and Riding Light is actually the first piece that I ever finished, that I ever started and finished, that solo cello piece. So that was me sort of saying, okay, well, I will walk the walk, not just talk the talk.
Huh. So was there a thing about pieces being written in part but not being able to finish them? Like, what was the being able to finish? What was that about?
Well, honestly, it was just that someone else asked me to do it and was going to pay me. And so, okay. So I had, and there was a performance. But what I had done in the past, the closest thing to a composition that I ever done, I had done a few arrangements, not very many, but a few arrangements. And even those, most of, like Stairway to Heaven for cellos, or some Radiohead songs for various mixes of the Messiaen ensemble, the Quartet for the End of Time ensemble, plus other instruments. But most of them I had not actually finished. I had sort of like gotten it close enough and then talked people through it in rehearsal. So, and those are just arrangements. And then I did a project the year before I started composing Riding Light, with Anna Deavere Smith, who's an actor. Mm-hmm. And so originally I was going to use Bach, but we determined pretty quickly that it would be sad to chop the Bach up into the kind of lengths that we needed for various moods. And Anna really wanted music not to be background music, but to be another voice in her play, in her production, essentially another character.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to figure out what to do, and I improvised a little bit one day, and she was like, yeah, that can you just play that piece? And I was like, well, it's not a piece, I'm just making it up to try to find the right sound. She was like, oh, well, just, but can't, why can't you do that? And we had a tiny little argument before I was like, why can't I just do that?
Yeah.
So that experience was actually, let's say, half composed, because what I did, we did this play several times, and over the course of rehearsals each time I would figure out the basic melody or harmonic device or whatever kind of device I was using, and I would figure out how long it needed to be and where it needed to go. But I was really improvising the whole time, just closer and closer to something that was the same every time. It was never written down, except there was one or two melodies that I actually wrote down. And I kind of had a piece come out of that I played twice, where I wrote about a minute and a half of the beginning and a minute of the end, and in between I didn't know what to do, so I just made stuff up. So all that to say, it sort of did like organically make my way there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I mean this is an unfair question, but I'm wondering about how the process of creativity, or whatever that you know energy is that we have, how it differs for you when you think or are in the midst of performing, or you know, working on someone else's repertoire versus writing your own versus curating. Like, does it feel like different parts of your brain? Or yeah
it does. I think one of the things that I love, and I get back to this when I pick up the cello and start practicing, is one of the things I love about playing other people's music is that it's already there. There's no sitting around in silence for an hour saying it's just not good enough. You know, if it's not good enough, I know what to do. I've got the training to practice, and I've got the instructions on how it's supposed to sound right in front of me. There's a lot of variation, and we like to play that up, I think, as classical musicians, how much variation we have from performer to performer of the same piece. And it's true. I absolutely see that. But it's not nearly as stressful, I think, as sitting in front of the keyboard with a 90-minute timer on and a blank piece of paper with five lines over and over again, trying to turn that into a piece of music. And for me, that requires going to a place of so little judgment. It's so hard, because all day long, sort of like essentially training myself to judge sound immediately.
Yeah.
because I know what it's supposed to do. And then to get to the point where you can write something down on a piece of paper as a composer, you have to let go of that. You have to be okay with something not sounding good, because you have to get through the bad stuff to find the good. Yeah, even now I'm using good and bad. even if you find something that you don't think works, there are plenty of things that Beethoven did. It's like Beethoven was the master of finding something that if he hadn't figured out the exact way, Fifth Symphony is a perfect example. Ba 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 ba. What the heck is that? That was really just nothing. But what he did with that turned it into something amazing and powerful and memorable for hundreds of years.
Wow. So how do you get yourself to that place of letting go of the judgment? Do you have, and when you said the 90 minutes, do you usually give yourself a set amount of time?
I do, especially in the beginning, because otherwise it's really hard for me to, and I think for a lot of people, to sit there.
Yeah.
It's really hard because it's not easy. There are so many things I could be doing that would be productive and that would feel like I could check off the to-do list much faster. So when I'm sitting there in front of the keyboard and nothing's happening, I think the main thing is patience. Yeah. Really, the main part of creativity is patience, non-judgmental patience, and the willing to follow anything that comes up to see what happens with it without judging. Some of the things that I've ended up writing that I liked came out of initial gestures that I came up with because I was so frustrated and bored that I was like, okay, well, I'll just use the one I've come up with. And then several tries into it, discover that actually there's something there that I never saw before. And I have the opposite problem too, where sometimes, many times I'll come up with something super cool, but then it's just a fragment that's super cool and there's nothing you can do with it. And I might even get stuck for 20, 30 minutes playing it over and over again and just groove into it and loving it and then be like, but it doesn't fit and it's not going anywhere. So I need to go to, I don't know. It's patience.
Yeah.
Patience.
Yeah. Wow. So I'm wondering, God, everything's buzzing at me. I'm wondering how you handle setbacks in any situation, whether it's, you know, logistical, whether it's performance, curating, whatever. Like, have you found that there's a way that is sort of a pattern for you or a habit that you've grown into that works well?
Well, I don't know that I always do this, but I think anytime there's a setback, the first thing to do is to accept it and reset. I mean, you may even end up wanting to go to the same place, especially in a logistical situation. You still have to go to the same place, literally. Yeah. Or if it's an artistic or a career choice, you may still want the same outcome or to achieve the same goal, but to recognize that you cannot snap your fingers and change where you are, is important. That's the first thing, is recognizing where I actually am and the new relationship between that place and the goal, and to work with it on those terms. Now, often, if the setback was something that could be repeated for whatever reason, then I think it is important, although you absolutely must deal with reality instead of the fantasy of what you had wanted to happen. I think it's also important to recognize the elements at play and whether you can do anything to stop that from repeating it again. But that's not something that you can always deal with in the moment. You just have to make note of it. Remember the feeling. Remember how you got there. Make note of it so that as soon as you've gotten where you were trying to go, you can deal with that to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Wow.
But I don't always do that, I think.
Yeah, we're all human.
Hard.
Yeah.
Very hard.
Do you, I don't know if you have any kind of meditative practice that has helped you with this, both with the acceptance that you were talking about and that patience with the composition?
I do. I've not been so consistent lately with I actually meditate, not just a meditative style of, but actual meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very helpful with everything. And I, especially when I'm doing it consistently every day,
mm-hmm.
Those have been great times. But I also find that practicing can be a kind of meditation,
mm-hmm.
in that one of the most interesting things I think about practicing is that it is essentially digging into how we form habits.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about thinking. I mean, the fingers to a certain extent are of course very, very important. But if you want to maximize your potential, you really have to get the mind involved. And setbacks in practicing are a great place to learn about setbacks.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not nailing a certain passage, then you have to actually like understand where your technique is, and you have to understand where your mind is and whether you're getting in your own way somehow. And that is a place where I think the opportunities to learn patience are abundant.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a humbling process.
Yes.
Yeah. Is. Very cool. I want to also ask about how you think about dealing with your art and how you think about the business side of your career, and whether those feel in conflict or whether you've come to terms with it in a way that is working for you.
I have vacillated so much in this area. I grew up like probably many musicians out there right now, sort of just feeling like, and maybe this was something I was told explicitly, or maybe it was just in the ether, but feeling like if I got good enough at the cello, then everything else would just be taken care of.
Yeah.
And that's all I had to do.
Yeah.
Obviously that's not the case. And so, I have done a lot to learn about it, and most of the time in the past, not all of the time, and maybe not even barely, maybe it's barely most of the time, but I've thought of it as something that I have to do and I have to learn how to do, because that's just what I have to do, and I'm just gonna suck it up and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, a conflict. I have at times embraced it, especially when I've seen the creative control that it can give me,
mm-hmm.
That I wouldn't actually have if other people were always in charge of the business side of things. My current project, as far as that's concerned, and it's a big project, is as I'm currently reorganizing everything, including my bookshelf, but everything about the inner workings of the business of what I do is, one of the desired outcomes is that as I transition my thinking into operating a business, what that allows me to do is ensure that artistic, creative, and practice time are protected as a necessary part of the business. Because what has happened sometimes when I've been in conflict with that side of things is that the unwillingness to organize it all together as a big picture thing has led to a sort of what's next, whatever is in front of me, shooting from the hip, whatever analogy you want to use, an approach that doesn't actually feel good, feel organized. And the thing that almost always ends up suffering the most is practicing.
So
I want to create a business model essentially where everything is accounted for, and where practicing artistic and artistic creativity are actually at the center, so that a much better symbiosis of all of those things.
Wow. I have to say I'm very interested in this, because in this year that I've been out on my own without a day job, I've been thinking a lot about this conflict that most people have. And the weird thing that I've found is that in a strange way, by focusing on the business side, you can actually enhance the creative side in a weird way, because like you said, you have to look at the whole and figure out where your priorities are. And the weird thing for me is thinking about the business side for musicians is often about thinking about your audience, or what is your real mission? Like, what is my relationship with these yeah. people, and how, you know, what do I want out of this next project? So right. in a strange way, it can take you out of that weird, myopic, too self-centered place that it's easy to fall into, where your fears and your, you know, judgments and all of that is getting in the way of actually doing the work.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And I also find that the more I think about what I need to do outside of the practice room, the more focused and goal-driven my practicing is,
yeah.
and the more effective it is. And sometimes practicing is exploratory. That does exist. But even then, it's exploratory practicing, not just like, well, I need to get 4 hours in today, and as long as I do that, it's good,
yeah.
without a real goal.
Yeah. Wow. No, I'm just so... I'm glad to hear all of this, because I think it's sort of a mystery for most people. How do they even conceive of these things? And for the longest time, I just thought, well, there's like a firewall between these two areas, and everyone struggles with this. And they think that time management is like the only thing that they can do. But,
right.
you know, there's only 24 hours in the day, so... Huh. So what are some of the current projects that you're in the midst of that you're most excited about?
The current project that I've just rolled out is actually a composition. Although it's more than that, because I'm playing it with the Jack Quartet. It's a quintet mm-hmm. called Tornado.
Mm.
We had the world premiere in Santa Barbara in late June.
Mm-hmm.
It was a commission by the Music Academy of the West and Town Hall Seattle, which is my 10th year there, and we're out of the building next year.
Wow.
So we did that, and Jack and I have worked together before. Jefferson Friedman wrote us a wonderful quintet, and Ari Streitfeld, one of the former violinists mm-hmm. of Jack, arranged 5 madrigals by Gesualdo with all these fun effects, and we used Justice Nation, and it's so beautiful, so cool. So we're essentially building a quintet program piece by piece.
Oh.
And so that's how it's, you know, it's not just my composition. It's about this bigger view of collaboration and mm-hmm. having 2 cello quintets, which is really fun.
Yeah.
So we're going to be playing that quite a few places in the next season. We also do, Jay Campbell and I do a duo by John Zorn called Ouroboros. On the program as well, so it's a lot of fun because it's right in that the program is right in this zone where it is all new music, mm-hmm. but it's also very. I think the energies and the things that happen in the performance are very in this particular program are very accessible. So I'm excited to see. See it happening at these places that are not strictly new music venues.
Great.
Very, very rewarding. Yep.
Huh. And so many new music performers feel like they're in some sort of ghetto of only targeting certain presenters. So what have you done to break free of that? Or what would you suggest for people if they're trying to explore new possibilities?
Well, I think the number one thing is the music you play, obviously, and but that's not the only thing, because something doesn't have to already be relatable. Take the Zorn, the Ouroboros, mm-hmm. for example. It's a great example. It's just crazy, and it's you can't really say anything about it in new music terms to say that it's like it's not at all like the melodic, or you know, it's definitely not watered down in any sense. I think no matter where you're coming from, I don't think you could say that, and I don't even think you need to worry about that. Like I don't like when that happens, but I understand that a lot of times that might be part of the perspective of someone who's in that community, the new music community, and only in the new music community. So, I mean, I think thinking about music that represents something more than just delighting in music technique, and I think it's the same as what we do with a performance. You know, we all are impressed by someone who comes out there and nails everything perfectly, even if it's a bit boring. We're impressed as fellow musicians who are like, I know how difficult that is and I know what's going on. But we can't really expect someone who doesn't know anything to be moved. And we may ourselves also not be moved. So finding music that is actually moving and that we're passionate about, which exists and everywhere, and also you can find it, it's not by genre. You can find plenty of melodic and harmonic music that just is not moving, and it may be maybe a personal thing. So finding the music that really moves you the most and gets you going, and then finding a way to communicate that to the people that you're playing with so that they are, and I remember this from Ipka. This is one of the things I remember the most, is this session where the Red Wheelbarrow poem was told, and we learned about introducing pieces, giving people an emotional entry point.
Yeah.
And if you have your own emotional experience with a piece, then you can find a way to share that, which gives people a glimpse of what they might have. And that's an emotion. That is one way of finding an emotional entry point and connecting with audiences that don't understand solo ponticello or knocking on the bridge. But you can still do it. You can do it if you lead them to it.
Wow. Great. Well, thank you so much, Joshua. This has been a pleasure. I wonder, do you have any... I don't know. I'm just wondering, is there a recent insight that you've come to, either about music or life or anything? Like, is there a recent aha that you want to share?
This is not so recent, but I think it's so broadly applicable to every kind of performance that we do. It's applicable in the writing of music. It's applicable when you're playing the Beethoven violin concerto that everyone else has already played a million times. It's applicable when you're choosing the music for a wedding gig. It's applicable everywhere. And I know that like the writer James Joyce had something similar when he was asked why he always wrote about Ireland. But this idea came to me when I was writing my cello concerto and I was trying to find a way to connect, and I kept on struggling until I gave up and went in. And I started feeling like, to discover the universal, you actually have to find the most intensely personal, because that's something we all share, is this vulnerability of what's deep inside that no one else sees. And if you can tap into, in any level and on every level, if you can tap into the things that are most personal and find a way to share those, then that's when you hit something, I think, that is universal.
Wow. Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this. Yeah. And I look forward to hearing you more and hearing your works. Very cool.
Yeah. I hope so. I hope in person soon too.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I don't know whether my video has gotten any better. Maybe a little.
Oh, there we go. We're back.
Stabilized a little. Anyway, thanks a million, Joshua. I really appreciate this.
No problem, Angela.
Yeah. Look forward to connecting soon.
Sounds good.
All right.
Take care. Have a good morning.
Yep, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.